a fest. No, I say. At the same time, Evan barks, of course she's positive. The detective ignores him, her gaze hot on mine. No, you're not positive, or no, it's not true. I swallow, flashing an apologetic glance at Evan, who is shaking his head. No, I'm not positive. Evan's lawyer face clamps down, and he latches onto my biceps, hauls me out of my chair, and steers me over to the edge of the room, up against an empty spot of wall, pressed between a filing cabinet and a water cooler.
I don't even know where to start. No, scratch that. I do know. Iris, Will is dead.
Allegedly, I say, using his own term on him, and he throws up his hands. Look, I know how weird it sounds.
It doesn't sound weird. It sounds certifiably insane.
Will's name was on the passenger manifest. They found his ring at the crash site. Without a single scratch on it. How does that even happen? And they still haven't found any of his DNA.
Because they're still pulling body parts from the earth. Jesus, Iris, think about it. It'll be months before they identify everyone.
Okay. So, what about the text from the blocked number? Will's the only one who stands to lose anything by me being in Seattle. And he could track my phone to see when I was there and when I got back. And he would for sure know how to text me from an untraceable number. And then there's the letter that mysteriously appeared on my bathroom countertop in Will's handwriting and postmarked after the crash, telling me he's so sorry. I think he meant for leaving. For making me think he's dead. For breaking my heart.
The letter didn't mysteriously appear. It was delivered to your house by the United States Postal Service. It could be 10 years old, for all we know. Do you know how hard it is to fake your death?
I've already done this, you know. Had this argument with myself. Over and over and over. A million times in my head. And of course I know how certifiably insane it makes me sound. It's the reason I kept quiet for over a week now, even though I should have been listening to my gut, which is telling me he's not dead. It's telling me to find the money, because that's where Will is, too.
Evan pulls a hand down his face.
I really wish you told me this before we walked through the door.
Why? So you could give me my $5 back and tell me to hit the road? My tone is teasing, my voice stretched with a smile, my pathetic attempt at an apology, even though I'm not sorry. If the detective and I are right, if Will is not dead, then whatever I say or do to find him is something I'll never apologize for.
But Evan doesn't crack the slightest smile.
No. So I could tell you that faking your death isn't technically illegal, but it's impossible to do without committing a crime. Beyond the identity fraud and tax evasion, that money from Liberty Air and Will's life insurance, if you take it, you'll essentially be stealing it.
His message sinks my smile.
Oh. Yeah. Oh.
His gaze fishes over my shoulder, and his expression goes carefully blank. I turn, and the detective is still at her desk, watching us with an expression I can't read. He gives her his back and steps between us so that all I see is Evan.
Okay, new plan. Let's go back over there, explain to Detective What's-Her-Name that you're a grieving widow with an active imagination and some very wishful thinking. Then get the hell out of here.
On the ride back to the office, Evan and I agree to a couple of things. First, to table the is-he-or-isn't-he argument until either the airline finds biological evidence of Will being on that plane, or I receive another message from the blocked number. I'm also to document every text I receive from both numbers by making screenshots and saving them to a mutual Dropbox account Evan's assistant will set up for us. And finally, Evan will pass the 678 number along to a private detective he's worked with in the past for tracing.
The Atlanta PD are good, he says,
pulling to a stop behind my car in the parking garage.
But they're monumentally overworked and underpaid. My guy'll be much faster. In the meantime, set your house alarm and call me the second you receive another threat, okay?
I agree, but I don't reach for the door.
Evan, I want to apologize for what happened back there. I know I should have shared my suspicions long before we sat down with the detective. But who even comes up with that? Not a sane person, that's for sure. Until someone else voiced the idea that Will might still be alive, I didn't permit myself to think it even in my own head, because I didn't want to get my hopes up.
I shake my head.
I'm not doing a very good job of explaining, am I? None of this makes any sense.
No, it makes perfect sense. And you're not crazy. This situation is. For the record, my response was less about an attorney looking out for his client, and more about me trying to muster up genuine happiness for someone who found her husband alive, and then coming up empty. All I found was envy. I know that makes me sound like a miserable, petty asshole, but there it is. I'm a miserable, petty asshole.
You lost your family. You're allowed to be all those things.
The shadows under his eyes seem darker suddenly, the line of worry indented in his forehead deeper. We say goodbye, and I yank on the door handle, then think of one more thing.
What was her name?
Whose name? The detective's?
No. I shake my head. Your daughter's. What did you and Susanna name her?
Evan is still for a long moment.
Emmeline.
He clears his throat and says it again, offering up the word with a quiet reverence.
Emmeline. We called her Emma.
Beautiful.
I give his arm a quick squeeze, then slide out of his passenger seat.
I'll think of her every time I hear the name.
Chapter 23. On Sunday, Mom doesn't want to leave. There are two casseroles in the freezer, both big enough to share with half an army, she says. We're standing on my front porch, watching Dad shove the last of their things into the trunk down at the street. Dave and James left yesterday afternoon, and now Mom is milking every last second out of this goodbye.
I thought maybe you'd invite a couple of your girlfriends over this week. Call Lisa or Elizabeth or Christy. Ask them to keep you company.
Good idea.
I'm not quite as enthusiastic as I make it sound. I love my friends as much as any other girl, but after almost 2 weeks of constant company, I'm looking forward to a little quiet. Grief, after all, is a solitary venture.
And I froze the soup in individual portions. I thought you could take it into work for lunch or something. There are cookie balls in there, too, in a plastic bag. Just pop them in the oven whenever you need something sweet.
Mom, there's enough food in the freezer to last me until Christmas.
I know. It's just...
Worry crumples her forehead.
Are you sure you're going to be okay? I just hate the thought of you here all alone.
I won't be here most of the time. I'll be at work, and probably pulling extra hours. It's college acceptance season, so I'm sure there's plenty of drama to catch up on.
It's only 5 days, Jules.
My father calls up the yard.
She'll be fine.
She gears up to protest, and I link my arm through hers and pull her close.
He's right, Mom. I'll be fine. I promise.
She pushes up a watery grin.
I'm supposed to be the one comforting you, you know, not the other way around.
If it makes you feel any better, I'll promise to be a big fat mess when I see you again on Friday. She laughs and pulls me into a tearful hug.
Call me any time, okay? I can be here in 3.5 hours.
I know.
And you'll look at those venues like you promised? I left the addresses on the kitchen counter.
I will. I promise.
I walk her down to the car, dole out another round of hugs, and smile and wave until Dad steers their car around the corner. And then I head back up the yard to the house. The afternoon stretches in front of me like an open, empty road. I know just how I'm going to fill it. Back in the house, I slide my phone from my pocket. Siri, where can you hide $4.5 million? Siri spits out a list of possible answers, from which I glean that $1 million in tightly packed ones would fit into a grocery bag, a refrigerator crisper drawer, and a microwave. The information is both informative and ridiculous. Why would anyone want $1 million in $1 bills? But okay, assuming Will packed the money in hundreds or thousands instead, the dimensions would still be manageable. Even with the new alarm, this house isn't exactly the Federal Reserve, and there are only so many places in it to hide a wad of cash that large. Then again, Will is a techie. It would never occur to him to shove cash into a bag and lug it around with him. Any money movement would occur where he felt most comfortable, online. Okay, so I should be searching for what? An account number scribbled on a scrap of paper? A discarded and forgotten flash drive? The key to a safety deposit box? I groan at the prospect of searching for an unknown object the size of my pinky finger. I decide to start in the attic and work my way down. I dump out boxes and bags, check behind rafters and in suitcases, search in closets and under beds. I move furniture and pull up carpets. I fetch a screwdriver from the kitchen and open every vent, reaching inside as far as my arm will go. I check the freezer and in toilet tanks. The entire house is an emotional minefield, every room rigged with explosives. Will's jacket hanging on a hook by the back door, his favorite orange juice in the fridge, shoved behind a carton of creamer he never got a chance to put in his coffee. The framed poster we picked out together on a trip to New York City, hanging in the hall. The couch pillows he always thought were too many and would toss onto the floor. His razor, and a half-empty bottle of aftershave on the rim of his sink. I twist off the cap and press it to my nose, and the familiar scent makes me smile at the same time my eyes build with tears. Suddenly, I can't breathe. I know the science behind my reaction, that the olfactory bulb is connected to the areas in the brain that regulate emotions and memory, but I still feel assaulted by the surge of Will. I see him. I smell him. I hear his voice in my ear, feel his fingertips sliding down the skin of my back. The sensation is so overwhelming, I actually look for him in the mirror, but there's nothing behind me but wall. Sadness sinks like lead in my belly, and I screw on the cap, carry the bottle to my side of the bathroom, and sink onto the vanity stool. The 100-watt bulbs above my head are not kind. Greasy hair, sunken skin, a pimple brewing on my chin. I push to a stand, flip on the shower, return to the bottom drawer where I keep my face masks. I yank it open, and my heart stops, then cranks like a freight train engine starting up, hard and gaining speed. There, on top of the boxes and tubes and tubs, is another note, this time scribbled across a bright blue sticky. Stop searching, Iris. Leave it alone. I can't protect you if you don't. Chill bumps sprout over every inch of my skin, despite the steady puffs of steam surging from the open shower door, and I whirl around, sensing Will as surely as if he's still here, standing right behind me. Who put this here? How? When? I haven't opened this drawer since... before the crash? Yes, I'm positive of it. A slew of emotions screws tight around my chest. Elation. An I-told-you-so excitement. A relief so intense it turns my bones to sludge, and my body spills onto the stool. Will is alive. He has to be. This note in his handwriting proves it. A high and hysterical sound comes up my throat. Half laugh, half scream. And I tell myself to get a grip. If I were sitting on my own psychologist's couch, I would explain to myself that in wishing Will alive, I'm idealizing my fantasies and not participating in the reality of his death. That I'm using my denial as a defense mechanism and deferring the work I should be doing, that of grieving my husband. And yet, I can't convince myself of any of this, because this time, there's no denying the message. Stop searching. Leave it alone. And this time, the note came without an envelope, which means Will had to have put it here himself. I snatch my phone from the vanity counter and type the question that's been rolling through my mind like a song on repeat ever since the very first text. Will, is this you? My heart clenches like a fist. The reply comes 30 seconds later.
Iris.
Me. Iris what? It's a simple question, with a simple yes or no answer. Either you are or you aren't.
Unknown. Nothing about this situation is simple.
A flash of fury rises in me, swift and searing, and I'm suddenly done playing around. I want an answer. If Will is going to go to the trouble to sneak into our house and leave me handwritten notes, the least he can do is admit it's him. My thumbs stab out a reply. Me. Answer the damn question. Are you or are you not the man who looked me in the eye and promised until death do us part? I hold my breath and wait for an answer that doesn't come. Me. Tell me. Are you? I stare at the screen, willing the person on the other end to answer. Unknown.
I'm so sorry. I never wanted any of my problems to touch you.
A choked sound erupts up my chest. Me. I need to hear it. I need for you to tell me.
Unknown. Yes. I'm so sorry. But it's me. It's Will.
His reply releases every emotion I've kept pent up for these past 12 days. Anguish, fury, sorrow, relief, despair. They burst from me in ugly, gulping sobs, coming in waves so hard and so fast I can't catch my breath. My husband isn't dead. I hit dial, and as the number rings, it hits me. Will is alive, and yet he concocted an elaborate plan to make everyone, including me, his wife, his very favorite person on the planet, think he's not. He somehow got his name onto that passenger manifest, knowing it would break my heart. I end the call after the third ring. It comes over me slowly at first, like a storm brewing in the distance. My breath grows shallow and short. My fingertips and toes start to tingle. I stare at the paper between my fingers, and something cold and hard forms in my belly. It snakes through my body and shimmies under my skin and ignites like kerosene in my blood. And suddenly, I'm shaking. Will left me on purpose and for money. $4.5 million of it. Never has anyone made me feel so worthless. After my shower, I stomp downstairs in bare feet and wet hair. Sometime under the scalding water, when I was scrubbing my skin hard enough to make it bleed, my fury hardened into determination. Will wants me to stop searching? He wants me to leave it alone? Sorry, but no way I'm stopping now. In the kitchen, I flip on the water kettle and pull a mug from the cabinet. As I'm scrounging around in the pantry for a tea bag, a trio of new texts pings my phone, rolling from one into the next. Unknown.
I'm so sorry for everything. You have to know, you are the last person on the planet I'd ever want to hurt.
Unknown.
I don't want to involve you in my troubles, and I don't want you to have to lie. If the police come looking for me, if they confiscate your phone and find this number, it's okay. There's no way they'll ever trace it. There's no way they'll be able to implicate you.
Unknown.
Iris, are you there? Please talk to me.
I clench my teeth, turn off the ringer, and chuck the phone into the cutlery drawer. Once, when Will and I were still dating, he stood me up. There I was in high heels and a slinky black dress at the Rathbun bar, tipsy on lemon drop martinis and new love, and he forgot we had a date. By then, I knew he was a workaholic, and I figured he'd gotten sucked into designing software and lost all track of the time. 6:30 turned into 7, and 7 turned into 8. My worry turned into irritation, turned into anger. Finally, I slapped 2 20s onto the bar and called a cab, firing off a snarky text on the way home. It was a shame he wasn't there for the date, I told him, because it was our last. He must have checked his phone at somewhere around 11, because that's when he started blowing up my phone. He apologized. He begged my forgiveness. He suggested we both ditch work the next day so he could make it up to me. He promised to be thorough. I didn't respond to a single message, but his obvious fluster and steady perseverance got to me, and by midnight I cracked. I texted him that I was going to bed and we'd talk about it tomorrow. When he showed up at my door 15 minutes later, still frantic with worry, I let him in. I tried to stay mad, I really did, but I was soothed by his familiar body against mine, by the thump of his pulse in his neck. By the way, his lips were soft, but his arms strong as they steered me down the hallway into the bedroom. When the alarm buzzed on my nightstand the next morning, Will and I were still busy, and neither one of us was thinking about work. But forgetting a date is not the same as choosing money over me. It's not in the same stratosphere as breaking your wife's heart by faking your death. This time, I will not be soothed. I leave my cell where it is, tangled in a dark drawer with the forks and knives and spoons, and fetch my laptop from the table. I need to back up, concentrate on the facts, and start at the very beginning. 4.5 million isn't exactly petty cash. You can't just swipe it from the company account without somebody noticing. Maybe if I figure out how we took it, I'll find a clue as to where it is. I carry my computer over to the couch and type corporate embezzlement schemes into the Google search field. A California CFO pocketed almost 90 million. The head of a Chicago meat processing plant ran off with over 70 million. A VP of a West Coast merchandising company stole $65 million via a kickback scheme, then gambled all of it away. Closer to home, a Savannah employee benefits manager made off with more than $40 million in fraudulent wire transfers. And then my gaze falls on a story at the bottom of the page, and my heart rate spikes. With shaking fingers, I click on the link, which shoots me to a website profiling the nation's greatest unsolved mysteries. In the mid-90s, a man by the name of Javier Cardozo was accused of stealing over $73 million from his employer, a Boston mortgage bank. When the police arrived at his house to arrest him, they busted in his door to find the television on and a half-eaten plate of still-warm macaroni on the kitchen counter, but no Javier. Both he and the money, every single cent of the $73 million, had vanished. In a year or two, will Will's name be added to this list? I return to the embezzlement schemes and scroll through the links. From them, I learn 2 things. First, $4.5 million is chump change. I'm sure Nick and the APSEC board think otherwise, but the amount is little league compared to the others I come across. Second, the money is almost always taken by someone with direct access to the books. A corporate officer, a head of finance, someone who handles billing or payroll. Will was a software engineer. His programming skills may have brought in business for APSEC, but how could he get money out? There had to have been someone else involved. Someone higher up within the company. Someone who either paved Will's way or covered his tracks. Which brings me back to Nick. He didn't mention investigating any other employees, but then again, he was being purposefully vague, and technically, he did threaten me. He also said his job was on the line, so it's not a long stretch to think he might be desperate. I sigh and sink back into the couch, pushing my computer aside and picking up Dad's legal pad. I flip to a clean page and jot down what I know. 1. Money is missing from AppSec. $4.5 million and counting. 2. Nick thinks Will is the one who took it. And if I'm totally honest, so do I. 3. Will would have had to move funds from AppSec's account to one he controlled, and in multiple transfers spanning many months, if not years. 4. The money is not in the house, but a clue to where Will hid it might be. 5. Nick wants the money back. So does whoever is on the other end of the 678 number, and he's willing to kill for it. Same person? My heart gives a hard kick at the last one, and blood pulses in my head. Whoever it is hasn't texted again, but it's only a matter of time. You don't send a threat that specific, tell me where Will hid the money, or you'll be joining him, and then just fade away into silence. And if I'm to believe him, which I think I should, he knows how to get around an alarm. The growl of a lawnmower roars outside. A dog starts up across the street. Both spike my pulse, and I retrace my steps after my parents left, when I locked the doors and punched in the code on my gleaming keypad to arm the system. I tell myself I'm fine. I'm tucked safely behind the best alarm money can buy. Still, my heart doesn't quite settle. Chapter 24. The lawnmower sounds like it's coming from just on the other side of my kitchen window. I twist around on the couch, catching a split-second glimpse of a tall, dark figure before he disappears around the corner of the house. What the? I pop off the couch and run to the side window, peering through the glass at a shirtless and sweaty Corbin. He's got his head down, his shoulder muscles straining as he pushes a mower across a patch of grass that winds from the side of the house into the back. Beyond him, neat strips of cut grass lie in perfect rows across half the yard. The other half is still wild and unruly, thanks to an unseasonably wet spring and rapidly rising temperatures. Without thinking, I yank open the back door, and a siren slices through the air. Corbin's head jerks up in surprise, and his feet freeze on the lawn. I slam both palms over my ears. Oh, shit! There's no possible way he can hear me above the racket. He leans down and flips a switch on the side of the mower, as if that would help any. Hang on! I take off down the hallway to the front of the house and punch in the code on the alarm pad. The screeching stops instantly. A second or two of blissful silence before the house phone rings. I snatch the handheld from its stand on the kitchen counter on the way back to the yard, willing my heart to settle. On a bright note, at least I know the alarm works. Any intruder who isn't halfway to Florida by now would have to be either deaf or dead on the floor from a heart attack. Hello?
We've received an alert for 4538 Ashland Avenue. Do you need us to send the authorities?
Oh, no, sorry. False alarm, and totally my fault. I'm still getting used to this thing, and I forgot to turn it off before I opened the door.
Can you please confirm the error?
I thought I just did. I step into a slice of sunshine in the backyard, where Corbin is standing, hands to his hips, at the edge of the terrace. I wave an everything's okay hand, and he traipses back over to the mower.
I need to hear the code word, ma'am.
That's right, the code word. The one Big Jim said they'd ask for each time I spoke to them on the phone. The one that lets them know everything is okay. Rugby.
Thank you, ma'am. You have a nice day.
I drop the phone onto a stone table and turn toward Corbin with an apologetic wave. What are you doing here? Corbin looks pointedly behind him at a strip of freshly mowed grass, then back to me.
I'm mowing your lawn.
I can see that. It's just, my yard service is going to be really confused when they show up here Tuesday morning. They're going to think I'm cheating on them. Corbin gives me an oh-well grin.
Best to keep those guys on their toes. Men work harder if they think they've got competition.
Before I can respond, he yanks on the cord to start up the mower and gets back to work. While he's finishing up, I fetch two Heinekens from the kitchen and carry them out onto the terrace, falling into one of the chairs in a patch of late afternoon sunshine. I inhale the scent of freshly cut grass and taste the tang of beer on my tongue, watching Corbin push the lawnmower back and forth across my grass as if it weighed nothing. He really is a fine specimen of a man. Lean and dark and slick with sweat, his muscles bulked up under his skin. Maybe that's why Will didn't introduce us, because he was afraid of the competition. He must have seen how girls fell all over themselves for Corbin at the gym. Maybe Will was afraid I would do the same. I think of my husband, and my heart gives a happy flutter. At the same time, the hurt comes flooding back, razor sharp, and every bit just as heavy as before. The reminder sweeps heat through my veins. Will chose money over me, over us. Good. Anger is good, because hurt will make me cry, and once I start, I'm afraid I won't be able to stop. Corbin reaches the end of the lawn, flips a switch, and the backyard plunges into silence. I pick up the second bottle, wag it in the air. A beer for your troubles?
Thanks.
Corbin pulls a t-shirt from his back pocket and uses it to wipe his face, walking across the newly cut grass.
There's nothing better than a cold beer after mowing. Nothing.
He takes it from my hand with a grateful nod, taps the neck against mine.
Cheers.
We both take a long pull from our bottles. Corbin sinks into the chair next to me. So, I say, does mowing my lawn fall in the category of looking out for me?
Yep, and while I'm here, I might as well take care of anything else you need done. A room that needs painting, maybe, or a drain that's stopped up. I can clean gutters, too. And when's the last time you had the oil changed in your car?
I feel a twinge at the memory of that rainy morning 12 days ago, when Will asked me the same thing as we spooned in bed. But I swallow everything down, along with another sip of beer. You're just the complete handyman package, aren't you? A self-deprecating smile slides up one side of his face.
It's one of the few pros of growing up with ADD. You learn to do a lot of things when you can't sit still for longer than 30 seconds. Plus, my father wasn't around to take care of things. I was the oldest of 5 kids, and Mom needed all the help she could get.
My psychologist training kicks in before I can stop myself. That's a lot of responsibility for a kid. He gives me a one-shouldered shrug.
I didn't mind. I kind of liked bossing the other kids around. Not that my sisters ever listened. Still don't. They're stubborn as mules, just like our mom.
His easy smile says he loves them for it. Why didn't Will ever introduce us? I mean, he obviously talked a lot about me to you, but he kept your friendship a secret from me. Why do you think he did that? If Corbin is surprised at my sudden change of subject, he doesn't show it. He leans back in his chair and blows out a long breath.
I've asked myself that question at least 1,000,000 times. Will wasn't exactly a spontaneous guy, so I'm sure he had a long list of well-thought-out reasons. But for the life of me, I can't come up with any explanation but one. Maybe our friendship wasn't as good as I assumed it was. I mean, I thought we were tight, but maybe I was wrong.
And yet, you still came all the way over here to mow the widow's yard.
It wasn't that far. My house is barely outside the perimeter.
I know Corbin is joking, trying to make light of whatever moral obligation brought him here from the Atlanta suburbs, but his tone carries an edge that tells me the subject is anything but jovial. He's hurt, snubbed by the fact my husband kept their friendship from me, which in my book makes it even more admirable that he came here today. Thank you, Corbin. You didn't have to do any of this, but I really appreciate you looking out for me.
I'm glad to. Because, honestly, now that I know what I know...
He glances over, and something flashes across his face, something that makes him look sheepish.
I'm wondering if maybe the problem was me.
I settle my beer onto a stone coaster. What do you mean?
I already told you I thought Will was acting funny. I saw the signs, and I registered them, but I never reacted, not once. Not even when he made me make that promise to watch out for you. Let's be honest. You don't ask a friend to take care of your wife if you're not worried something's about to happen. But not once did I ever sit him down and say, "Hey, man, what's going on with you? Do you need a hand?"
He lifts both shoulders high, then lets them drop.
Looks like I was the shitty friend in this equation, not Will.
I take a long draw from my bottle, but the cold liquid does nothing to budge the sudden lump in my throat. Corbin may have been a shitty friend, but what does that make me? What kind of wife doesn't notice when her husband is in so much trouble that the only way out is by faking his own death? An even shittier one. The answer makes me dizzy and unstable, like I've suddenly become unmoored. I plant my feet onto the cement pavers and my palms on the hard seat under me, searching for contact with the earth. Corbin's confession puts us on the same playing field somehow. When it comes to my husband, we've both been betrayed. We've both failed. That's the only excuse I have for what I say next. "There's some money missing from Will's company," I say, watching a squirrel sway in a neighbor's branch. I can't bear to see the surprise, I imagine, climbing Corbin's face, or even worse, judgment. "A lot of money, actually. 4.5 million and counting, according to his boss. No charges have been filed yet, but it's only a matter of time. The folks at APSEC seem pretty certain it was Will." There's a long beat of silence, and then another. I look over, and Corbin is watching me with a face so straight it's deadpan. He holds on to it for another few seconds, and then he presses a palm to his bare stomach and bursts out laughing. "I'm serious, Corbin. This isn't a joke." He gives me a come-on look.
"Will Griffith drove an old jalopy with a hole in the floorboard and a seriously questionable transmission. If he came into some sudden cash, don't you think he would have splurged on a better ride? Or, hell, I don't know, bought himself a wallet that wasn't held together with duct tape?
He splurged on jewelry."
"Please. The only jewelry he ever wore was the wedding ring you bought him. And before you say anything, his watch doesn't count. I'm pretty sure that thing was made of plastic."
"For me," I twist my hand around, and the Cartier winks in the sunshine. "He splurged on jewelry for me." Corbin's smile drops like a guillotine.
"That ring doesn't prove a thing. Will didn't like to spend money on himself, but he would gladly spend it on you. He probably saved up for months, or maybe he financed it. Doesn't matter. The point is, he had a good job. He did well enough for an occasional splurge."
"He paid cash."
"Okay, I'll admit, it doesn't look good. But I don't know."
Corbin swallows, and doubt pushes across his face like a shadow.
"Do you think he took it?"
I lift both shoulders to my ears. "If he did, it's not in our bank account, not in the house either."
"Where else could it be?"
I don't answer, because suddenly, the missing Will part steamrolls me. I may live to be 80, to pay off this house Will and I bought together, but I'll be doing it alone. His legs won't warm my cold feet. His smiles won't piece together my broken heart. As furious as I am at him for choosing money over me, I'm also flattened and lost without my husband.
"I know," Corbin says softly. "I miss him too."
I nod, trying to drum up some of my earlier anger, but it seems to have abandoned me. The only thing I can manage to muster up is more sorrow. For Will, for me, for Corbin, grieving a lost friend. "I owe you an apology, you know." Corbin's head swings my way, his forehead creasing.
"What for?"
"I found a note. Two, actually. Both in Will's handwriting. Both showed up after the crash." I've stunned him silent. It takes him a second or two to get his bearings.
What did they say?"
"The first one said, 'I'm so sorry.' The second told me I was in danger, and to stop snooping into Will's past. I went to Seattle after the crash. I talked to people who remembered him. I shake my head. There was lots of drama, none of it good.
What drama? What happened?
Drugs, arson, depending on who and what you believe, maybe murder. I met the father I thought died ages ago. Not that he was in a state to tell me anything. He has Alzheimer's, and it's pretty advanced. But none of that is my point. My point is, when I met you the other morning for coffee, I suspected you. I thought you sent the notes to, I don't know, to trick or torture me or something.
Indignation straightens Corbin's spine.
I would never.
I know. I pause to give him a smile. That's why I'm apologizing. He smiles back.
Forgiven.
Just like that?
Just like that.
We sit for a bit, each of us lost in our thoughts. I lean back in the chair and Corbin does the same, stretching his long legs out before him, closing his eyes to the sun. A shrieking comes from a few houses down, children playing in a yard somewhere, and beyond that, the faint and familiar rumble of traffic.
So wait,
Corbin says, his eyes snapping open with sudden realization.
Since I didn't send the notes, who did?
I don't answer, or maybe I do. Corbin studies me with an intense gaze, and from the way his mouth is drawn tight, I can tell he reads my message in the silence. His eyes go big and round.
No.
I hesitate only a second. I've already started down this path, and after the way he's responded today, my instinct says he can be trusted. There have also been some texts.
Saying what?
Lots of things. But in the last ones, he admitted it was him.
No. No! That's...
He passes a hand over his mouth and shakes his head, a hard back and forth, like a dog trying to choke up a bone.
That's not possible. That's insane.
Of course it's insane, but so is stealing $4.5 million from your employer. You said it yourself. Will was acting funny. What if he was faced with a choice? Go to jail or disappear? What if he didn't love me enough to do the right thing? As I say the words, my voice breaks and my eyes fill with tears. And I was right before, when I thought that once I started crying, I wouldn't be able to stop, because that's exactly what happens. The wound feels ripped open all over again, fresh and jagged, and I wrap both my arms around my waist, fold myself double, and sob. And it's not the pretty kind of cry either. It's the kind that sucks the breath from my lungs and screws up my face and turns it all red and snotty. Because this is what it's all about, isn't it? In the end, Will didn't love me enough. Poor Corbin. He looks like he's at a loss. He's a man without a clue what to do with a sobbing pseudo-widow. So he just sits there, stiff and uncomfortable, his gaze scanning my face, like he's searching for something. Any indication for how to make me stop crying, most likely. It takes me forever to wind down, for my sinuses to stop streaming and the wails to taper into whimpers. When finally I'm able to suck a long, shaky breath, he passes me his shirt to mop up my face. The cloth smells like grass and cologne and man. And it makes me miss my husband even more.
There's just one thing I don't understand.
I bark a wet laugh at the irony.
Just one? Because there are a million things I don't understand.
He takes a long last slug of beer, draining his bottle.
If Will's not dead, then where is he? Where'd he go?
I hike my shoulders to my ears again.
Wherever the money is, of course.
Chapter 25. That night, I don't sleep. Fury pumps like a cactus through my veins, poking me with pointy fingers. Every time I threaten to drift off, it reminds me of my phone downstairs, tangled among the forks and knives, beeping and buzzing with Will's incoming texts. How many has he sent by now? 10? 20? 40? I glare at the ceiling, clench my teeth until my jaw aches, and tell myself I don't care. If Dave were still here, I'd pad into his room and bomb another one of his magic blue pills. After yesterday, no, after the past 2 weeks, I could use a night of deep and dreamless sleep, if for nothing else than to keep me away from my phone. By morning, my brain, soaked with adrenaline and fury, feels numb, and I throw back my covers with relief. I shower and brush my teeth like any normal Monday morning. I dry my hair and put on my makeup. I shove my limbs into a skirt and blouse, and my feet into my favorite pair of high heels, and teeter downstairs to scrounge up coffee. Normalcy is what I need. A normal widow would call in sick today. She'd spend the day in bed, wrapped in her dead husband's bathrobe, and binging on Oreos dipped in peanut butter, and hiding from the world. And a normal boss would understand. Ted would reply with a whole slew of platitudes he'd actually mean, telling me to take my time, to not rush things, that my office will be waiting for me whenever I'm ready. Only, I'm not a normal widow, am I? My husband, the same husband who 13 days ago dived to his death in a westward-bound 737, is not really dead, which means I'm also not really a widow. As the coffee is brewing, I sneak a peek into the cutlery drawer. The phone screen is black. I tap the button with a finger, and nothing happens. The battery is dead. Ha! I bark into my empty kitchen, slamming the drawer shut. It feels like a small kind of victory. What could Will possibly say to make this better? What excuse could he possibly have? And if he went to all this trouble to fake his death, why bother texting me at all? How does he know I won't march into the police station with my phone, fork it over for their detectives to use as Exhibit A? That last one stops me on the kitchen tiles. Could I really turn in my own husband? Should I? I've always believed that stealing is a crime worthy of punishment, but the thought of my husband, my Will, wasting away behind bars somewhere, squeezes a spiky ball of nausea in my stomach. And then I think of his mother and those two poor children sleeping in their beds when a fire tore through their building. What if Will was the one who said it? What if he'd gone to prison and we'd never met? How different my life would have been. How empty. I have so many questions. Maybe I should give him a listen, see what he has to say before making any decisions. The coffee sputters to a stop, and I pour it into a big gulp-sized travel mug. I grab a granola bar from the pantry, my keys, and a bag from the counter, and my dead phone from the drawer. Later. I'll give him a listen later. High schoolers swarm the parking lot when I swing into Lake Forest at 15 minutes before first bell. They watch me pass from behind designer sunglasses, not even trying to hide their stares and double takes. I'm like a subject for one of their psych experiments, an alien who's just arrived from planet Widow. They're studying me for signs the aliens have sucked out my brain and replaced it with one of theirs. Josh Woodruff, a senior, climbs out of the car next to mine, squinting at me over the roof of his hardtop convertible.
Hey, Mrs. Griffith, are you okay?
I wince and punch the lock button on my key fob, pulling out my sunniest smile. Good morning, Josh. Any news? His frown clears to a mask of mock modesty, and he begins listing off the college letters he's received, all acceptances and all top-tier schools, but not the one his parents are pushing for.
Still nothing from Harvard, though.
No matter what they come back with, you should be proud. You've already got an impressive list of schools who want you to wear their jerseys. He gives me an I-guess shrug.
Dad's still working his contacts, so hopefully I'll hear back soon.
Fingers crossed! I push all sorts of brightness into my answer, though for these kids, luck has nothing to do with it. For them, Success is built on two things, and two things only. Hard work and network. Money is a given, and failure is not an option. Josh smiles at me in an absent-minded sort of way, then stands there until I turn away, toward the high school building. The morning air is cool, but the parking lot feels like a giant hill I have to climb in 100-degree heat. I clack across the asphalt, trying not to work up a sweat in the early morning sun, but my silk blouse is already sticking to my skin.
Hi, Bridget. Good morning, Isabella. You ladies are looking extra perky this morning.
They don't look extra perky. They look like two half-asleep teenagers who stumbled into an AP calculus class by accident.
Mrs. Griffith, are you okay?
One of them asks. I swallow down a sigh.
Perfectly fine, thank you.
Bridget waves a hand at my torso.
Like, you do realize your shirt is on inside out, right?
I look down, and she's right, damn it. The laundry tag flutters at my waist, and the seams are raw and raggedy. I fold my arms across my chest and try to hold her gaze. I'll fix it as soon as I'm inside.
And you're only wearing one earring, Isabella says.
My fingers fly to my ears, my thumb closing in on a bare left earlobe, and a hot flush climbs my face.
Jesus!
No wonder the kids are stopping to watch me lumber across the parking lot, gawking at the poor widow who came to school looking like an unmade bed. I pluck out the other hoop and drop it into my bag, at the same time checking my skirt and sneaking a peek at my pumps. They match, thank God. I was in a hurry this morning, obviously.
Obviously, they say in unison.
Without another word, I turn and head for the building. Planning a sensitivity training workshop moves to the top of my to-do list. Ava is in my office when I walk through the door. I'm not all that surprised to see her here. No one takes advantage of my open-door policy more than Ava, though she's usually slumped in the corner stool, a spot she sits in so often her name should be stitched across the back like a director's chair. Today, though, she stands, stiff and twitchy, in the center of the room, her backpack hung over a shoulder, her fingers white where they grip the strap. And she seems a little out of breath.
Somebody told me you were back, but...
Good morning, Ava. How was your weekend? She shifts her way to her other leg and rings a manicured finger, casting an anxious glance at whoever is standing in the hallway.
What?
I step around her to the other side of my desk, dropping my bag on the floor before I fall into my chair. Will's picture, the one of him from last year's Music Midtown, smiles at me from next to my computer screen. I open my bottom drawer and chuck it in, frame and all. I asked you how your weekend was.
Oh, fine, I guess.
She chews on her bottom lip, plump and perfectly glossed, her gaze flitting around the room.
Mr. Rawlings told us you wouldn't be back for a while.
I've always liked Ted, but imagining his face at the town hall meeting when he said those words, his furrowed brow and compassionate tone as he implied I was at home falling apart, I can barely contain my cringe. I don't want anyone's sympathy. I don't deserve it.
I wanted to call, she says, but I didn't have your number.
Ava moves closer to the desk, a conscious step into my field of vision.
And I thought about stopping by, but I didn't know how you'd feel about me just showing up unannounced at your house.
My gaze shoots to hers. Why? Her pretty forehead crumples in a frown.
Why didn't I know how you'd feel?
Why would you show up at my house unannounced? Why would you even consider it? The questions come out like angry accusations. And I know I'm being rude and unreasonable, but I can't stop myself. There are too many conversations going on here. With Ava, with her nervously animated hands and my accusing glares, with the phone that's dead in my bag, and my senses are overloaded. It's like I'm watching television and blasting the radio and talking all at the same time. I need for at least one of the noises to shut the hell up.
Because I...
She comes strong out of the gate, then fumbles, a her words trailing away into nothing. She backs away from the desk, drops her backpack onto the floor, and sits, her back ramrod straight, on the corner chair. Outside my office door, the hallway is quiet, the rest of the kids in class.
I wanted to know how you were doing. I was worried.
It's not just her words that suck the steam from my anger, but also her tone, hesitant and unsure. I should apologize. I should open my mouth and tell her I'm sorry for using her as an emotional punching bag, but I can't seem to make myself. I'm too uncomfortable with where this conversation is headed, so instead, I flip it back onto her.
I appreciate your concern. Thank you.
So, how are things going with Charlotte Wilbanks? Any new arguments I should know about? Ava's pretty blue eyes bug, the facial equivalent of, "Are you kidding me?" She doesn't speak for a good 10 seconds.
Fighting with Charlotte is just so pointless.
Good for you. That's a very mature stance to take. What about you and Adam Nightingale? Are you two still an item?
Charlotte can have him. All Adam wants to do is play the guitar or have sex. And honestly,
she makes a face. He's not very good at either. She leans back in her chair, studying me over my desk, with a tenderness I didn't know she was capable of.
My mom left.
At first I think I didn't hear her right. What do you mean she left? Left where?
Our house. My dad.
She went to live in Sandy Springs with some mechanic named Bruce. She says it like she'd report the weather, flat and matter of fact.
Apparently they're in love or something.
I lean back in my chair, blowing out a breath. Okay. Wow. That must be a huge adjustment for you. I'll say. You should see my room at Bruce's house. It's tiny. She gives me a half grin to let me know she's not entirely serious.
I meant your parents splitting up.
Ava pulls a hunk of hair over her shoulder and winds the ends around a finger.
I don't know. It's not like my dad was the greatest husband or anything. He's hardly ever at home. And when he is, he's always on the phone or behind his computer. I'm not entirely positive he's noticed she's gone. And Mom does seem a lot happier now. She smiles literally all the time.
Divorce is tough on everyone involved. But you know this is something between your parents, right? It has nothing to do with you. She nods like she doesn't quite believe me.
You want to know the craziest thing?
Mom didn't take anything but the clothes on her back. Not her jewelry, not her car, not even her Birkin bag. Last Christmas, she couldn't live without a pink diamond Rolex, and now the only thing she wants is 50-50 custody. It sounds like she's found something much more valuable. I think about Will, about how empty my life is without him in it, about how he's back and blowing up my phone with text messages I don't dare to read, and a pang hits me in the center of the chest. Ava lifts a bony shoulder.
I guess Bruce is okay.
I meant you. She might be leaving your father, but it sounds like she's still very much committed to you. For once, Ava doesn't try to bite down on her smile. She just looks at me and lets it rip, and her happiness lights up her face. She really is a beautiful girl, and I'm about to tell her she should smile more often when the bigger picture occurs to me.
You seem surprisingly okay with all of this. How come?
She unwinds her finger, pushing the hair back over her shoulder, and straightens her Lake Forest sweater.
Honestly? Because of you. Because of what happened to your husband. Things like that make you realize what's really important. And it's not another diamond Rolex, you know? Like, life is too short to be focused on all the wrong things. And just like that, I'm crying. For me, for Will, for Ava and her mother. This is the moment every counselor works for.
That aha moment of breakthrough when their student sheds some of the baggage weighing them down. But because of my own baggage, I'm too emotional to say a word.
Anyway,
she swipes her backpack from the floor and pushes to a stand.
I didn't mean to.